Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest today is Walter Cruttendon. Walter has been doing an enormous amount of research specifically as to why our ancestors were so obsessed with the stars and all things astronomical. And really, whenever you look into astronomy, you find that our ancestors were so enamored by it that you really beg the question as to why that is. And when you look at civilizations like ancient Egypt and the Mayans, you actually find that they're obsessed by it. And so Walter has written a book, and he's also in a DVD. He's the host, the organizer of a yearly conference on all of these subjects, and he will tell us more about this in due course. But Kathleen, when you were preparing for this show, you came up with what you felt was a great observation Walter had made, and which kind of is a good starter for this show.
Well, Philip introduced me to Walter's work, which I was not aware of, but I've certainly heard of. I just hadn't done any investigation into it. And I started reading about his work, your work, Walter, on history and celestial time. And I started looking into a conference that you had done on precession and ancient knowledge. And there, first of all, your work is so exciting because there's so much depth to it, and there's so many layers to it. But one of the things that really struck me, that, you know, this is my bailiwick, that grabbed me, and I said, okay, this is the kind of thing that I care about and my readers care about, is you talked about historical perspective. And one of the things that you say is that current theories of history generally ignore myth and folklore and do not consider macro external influences on consciousness. Now, that is a huge statement, and a really important one. And I'd love to start there. I'd love to start with asking you to talk a little bit about this idea and how it informed your work and where it takes us.
Excellent. Excellent. Good starting point. You know, there's a terrific anthropologist by the name of Jared Diamond, and he wrote a famous book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. And in that book, he argues, and does a good job, I think, of saying that those cultures that had the guns, the germs, the bad germs, and the steel tended to dominate over those that didn't, because these things give people an advantage when they're trying to succeed in a material society. And so he's making the point that environment matters. And so the point I'm trying to make is very similar, that it's not just the local environment that affects us, but it's also the macro environment that affects us. And to put that in perspective, think of the Earth's rotation on its axis, the diurnal motion. That causes a cycle of night and day, which dramatically affects us, affects our consciousness. You know, we go from subconscious to waking state, and photosynthesis occurs, and we're all very active. And then when the Earth turns away from the sun again, we slowly slip back into the subconscious or sleep state. Likewise, the second motion of the Earth has a dramatic effect on all life. You know, in the springtime, things pop out of the ground, and in the trillions bloom, give their fruit, and then by fall, they're decaying again, and you know, billions of animals are hibernating or coming out of hibernation and spawning and migrating in mass. And that's all due to the second motion of the Earth. And so if there is a third motion, as some of these ancient cultures hinted about, then you would expect that to have an effect also. And so, starting with myth and folklore, we find that a lot of ancient cultures talked about a rise and fall of consciousness, or ages, if you will, yugas, right? You know, different cultures had different names for it, but they all seemed to tie it to the motion of the heavens. And there was one really great author that wrote about this, Giorgio De Santayana, the former professor of the history of science at MIT. He wrote a book called Hamlet's Mill, along with Hertha von Deschen, who was an anthropologist out of Goethe University in Frankfurt. And the two of them were first just sort of looking for the origins of science. As a matter of fact, Giorgio had written an earlier book with that title, The Origin of Science. And they figured if they looked at some of the very ancient myths, they would get some clues. And what they found was that all these ancient cultures were fascinated with the stars and counting the stars and, you know, giving us concepts like day and year and time. And they also gave us a concept called the great year. At least that was Plato's name for it. And so, you know, rather than just take some parts of the mythology and throw away these other parts because we may not understand them yet, we've looked very carefully at this concept of a great year or yuga cycle or precession equinox, whatever you want to call it, and found out that there is a lot of evidence for it. In fact, you know, ancient cultures around the world seem to be far more advanced prior to the Dark Ages than during the Dark Ages. And so that's kind of where our work began.
And this idea of the great year, does it culminate in a golden age? Is that what we're talking about, a period of a golden age, and then we go back into a cycle?
We actually unfold like the seasons unfold. We go from iron, bronze, to a silver and golden age. And the Greeks said that each of these ages have certain characteristics. Hesiod wrote about it in beautiful terms. You know, he said the golden age is a time of peace and plenty when the earth just literally gives of itself like a mother, and life is very easy, versus some of the other ages, they get progressively harder as you go to a lower age. And they also put sort of physical or consciousness characteristics on them. They called the Iron Age the Age of Man, material age, and they called the Bronze Age the Age of the Hero, with the Silver Age being the age of the demigods, and of course the Golden Age being the age of the gods. And you know, in Hollywood today we hear about demigods, and we're sort of led to believe that that's when a god marries a man. But the ancient Greek teachings would actually tell us that no, that's when a man becomes a god, or he's halfway to becoming a god.
So when we're talking about this great age, it's the cycle of roughly 26,000 years, which we've sort of divided into the zodiac. And or is this one of the misconceptions? Is it what is really going on there? Because in your research, you've really begun to understand that there is far more to it than that.
Yep. That's a good place to start, though, Philip, because the ancients used the zodiac just like we use the numbers on a clock. A matter of fact, our daily system of time is based on the great year. It's just a little microcosm of the great year, and I'll point that out in a minute. But if you look at the stars all around us, if we had X-ray vision and could just see all the constellations, we'd notice that there's 12 major constellations that lie along the ecliptic, which is basically the Earth's path around the sun. And obviously these constellations are much farther out, but they act as marker points. And so if you just squish this onto a 2D piece of paper, those would be fairly evenly dispersed in a circle around the Earth. And they act like, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, etc. So generally Aries is put at the top, and then Pisces just to its right in the 1 o'clock position, and then Aquarius and so forth. And so you've heard this term that, you know, we're in Pisces at the dawning of the age of Aquarius. That simply says the sun on the spring equinox is actually in that constellation. If you could see the stars behind the sun, you would see the stars of the Pisces constellation, the fish. And the sun slowly moves across the sky, going through all 12 constellations in a period of roughly 24 to 26,000 years. And over this period of time, what the ancients tell us is that not only does the sun move, but there's different epochs of time where the Earth goes through dramatic changes, and so does mankind internally.
So it's basically a construct of astrology, as above, so below.
It is, yeah. And I think that, you know, I really don't know much about astrology. I talk to astrologists all the time because they love this simple idea of what's behind the zodiac, that it's actual physical motion there that we're seeing. But, you know, I'm just looking at this in scientific terms. It seems we can see, if we observe the sun, that it moves through these constellations. And we can see that over time, history definitely changes, and that before the Dark Ages, there were a lot of great civilizations around, you know, Mesopotamia, Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, wonderful knowledge of astronomy, mathematics, medicine, advanced engineering. They still use the underground sewer systems, the Qanats, you know, in parts of Syria. Same thing in ancient India, in Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. They built with uniform bricks. They had indoor plumbing and heating. I mean, Europe didn't get back to that after the Dark Ages until, you know, just a few hundred years ago. And, you know, there's a lot of myth and folklore about quite a number of advanced civilizations around the world living fairly well together. And then as we're falling out of the higher ages, you know, then not till about 3000 BC, 2500 BC, do you start to find weapons in the archaeological record. And then, of course, things get just more and more goofed up until, you know, 1,000 years ago in the depths of the Dark Ages, literally every nation was at war with one another, even 500 years ago. And since then, we've had a renaissance, a sort of a discovery as we've come out of the lowest age and we're just creeping into the next higher age, what the Greeks would call the Bronze or the Indians would call the Dwapara Yuga. And that age is an age of awakening, an age when we're supposed to discover finer forces. And these things are written about long ago. And if you look at the scientific record, you know, the last few hundred years or so since the Renaissance, indeed, we are going from sort of a consciousness where we think of ourselves as just a physical being on a physical earth to we're discovering molecules and electricity and magnetism. And we're realizing that what we thought was so solid isn't so solid after all. It's made of atoms, and that's made of 99.9% space. And we're realizing, just as sort of predicted by these ancient cultures, that that the world changes, or if you will, consciousness changes, so we see the world differently.
So based on these ideas, that we are essentially in an early phase of a Bronze Age, if I'm hearing you correctly, when was the last Golden Age? And how controversial is this idea in terms of what it does based on traditional history?
Good question. It's definitely controversial, you know, even though this was the dominant theory of history up to about 200 or 300 years ago, it's been shoved into the background by the concept of evolution. And I would agree that evolution exists on a long-term scale, but I think that there are cycles within evolution that we're not recognizing here, one of these being the Great Year. So the Great Year is, it takes the sun about 24,000 years to move through these 12 constellations. And at one end of it, call it 12 o'clock on the clock, or the Aries on the zodiac, that's when you have a golden age. And on the opposite end, what's that, Libra, you have the dark age. And so the golden age was roughly 13,500 years ago. And the dark age, you know, the depths of it were only about 1,500 years ago. The fall of all the great civilizations around the world, and finally the fall of Greece and Rome, and, you know, they're crucifying people in the streets over in the Americas. They're practicing human sacrifice. I mean, the world, they can't even build what they used to build. Their civilizations collapse. That's the Dark Ages, roughly 1,500 years ago. And if you look at the precession rate right now, the rate at which the sun moves across the stars to go through all these constellations, it's actually about 50.3 arc seconds per year. And at that rate, it would take about 25,700 years. And so some people use this 26,000-year number as what it would take to complete one whole cycle. But according to the teachings of Swami Sri Yukteswar, he wrote a book called The Holy Science, and he's probably the premier expert on the yugas. He says that the cycle actually takes about 24,000 years. And we checked his work out and did a lot of astronomical work. Here at the Binary Research Institute, we've hired astrophysicists, mathematicians, and we've noticed that the precession rate indeed has been increasing. We only have good records that go back a few hundred years, but it goes from 50.0 to 50.1 to 50.2 to now 50.3, and it's increasing at an increasing rate, an exponential rate. And so it looks very much like a body in an elliptical orbit. And when that body is, far away from its whatever it's gravitationally bound to, say the Earth, when it goes around the sun, goes in an elliptical orbit. At one point in its orbit, we're 95 million miles away from the sun. At another point in our orbit, we're only 91 million miles away. And when we're closer, we go faster. And so likewise, it appears that the whole solar system goes faster and faster as you get to a certain point here, then we go slower and slower. And so we believe the precession rate will average 24,000 years. And I'm sorry to labor the point, but it's important because if we look at our current system of time, we see that it's made of 12 hours of AM and 12 hours of PM. And in the AM, this is increasing light. We go from the darkest point to the lightest point, the zenith of the sun, 12 noon. And then the sun slowly goes down and you get to the darkest point again, PM. Well, that's an exact microcosm of the great year. The great year is 24,000 years, 12,000 years, our solar system moves towards the golden age, if you will, and 12,000 years it moves away from this sweet point in space. And, today nobody knows where our system of time came from. We can trace it as far back as Egypt and Babylonia and see pieces of it, but nobody knows where it came from. And it's so interesting how well it fits with the precession cycle, according to all this ancient myth and folklore.
You've been looking into various traditions. You've been mentioning the Greeks. You've been mentioning the Hindu mythology. What other cultures have you identified? And what specifically is it in those cultures which links it? Is there like, for example, in ancient Egypt, a connection to the age of the gods, when the gods were ruling on Earth? Is that the same thing with kind of like the time frame? And what do you think those gods then are?
Ooh, I love that question. yes, I speak mostly of the Vedic and Greek cultures because they happen to leave the most messages, the most myth and folklore and writings about it. Some of the Vedas were passed down verbally, word for word, for thousands of years. So there's really quite a lot of color on the characters of the different ages. But according to Giorgio de Santayana that I'd mentioned earlier, there's over 200 myths from 30 different cultures that talk about this great year cycle. And again, they use different terms, but these go from Polynesian cultures to Nordic cultures to, many of the Mediterranean cultures. Here in the Southwest where I live in the Americas, you have the Hopi Indian, and they talk about it as different worlds versus just south of here, where the Maya culture, which stemmed from the Olmec culture, was nested, they talked of it as different suns. And it's very similar language that during these different worlds or different suns, the world's going through these different epochs of time or consciousness. And, you know, even the Bible, you see a lot of references to it, say in the book of Daniel, they talk about, they get Daniel, who's sort of a mystic or a saint, to interpret the king's dream. And the king has seen a large statue with a head of gold, a chest of silver, a torso and upper legs of bronze, and legs of iron. And if you look at this is, you know, just again a beautiful metaphor for this cycle that the Greeks gave us with these different colors or different qualities of metals to it. And my point is, you find these stories everywhere in just about every ancient culture around the world today.
So what are the gods?
So what are the gods? Hey, they're you and me, aren't they? you know, if you we don't like to believe that, I guess, because we're so hypnotized by the material world in which we live. And I don't say that negatively. I just say that's the period of time that we're in now. But we're kind of like the mayfly. You know, this is a fly that lives for one day out of the whole year. And if it happens to be born on an overcast, windless day, then it knows nothing of, you know, sparkling sunshine or riding a breeze. And we're kind of like the mayfly. Our life, proportional to the great year, is the same as the mayfly's life, proportional to the annual year, solar year. And so we think that, you know, this is all there is. And we hear stories about long-lost higher ages, but because we can't even relate to it, that we just dismiss it. But, you know, there's some pretty credible people that tell these stories, even Jesus the Christ. You know, he said, "Is it not written that ye are gods? These things that I do, ye shall do also, and greater things." And he's telling us that we have this potential, as many of these myths and folklore, you know, that's the story of Jason and the Argonauts, the story of Hercules. They're all about finding this golden age consciousness. And yeah, so I think we are gods. But so that is us, Philip. That is us in a higher age without a lot of the baggage and the obscurity that exists in the current era, where it's very difficult to perceive what we are. So we just think we're nothing more than physical bodies.
And this is something which I think definitely the ancient Egyptians are saying about how we at one point had gods, then demigods, then we became humans. And in the Bible, obviously, you have these tremendous lifespans of the patriarchs. Is this like a global phenomenon? Whenever you look at mythology, is the same pattern there, or are there variations? And what can we take away from this all of this diverse information?
Yes, you do see this pattern globally. On the lifetimes, for example, if you look at the kings' periods in the ancient Egyptian records, you will see that the kings live a very long period of time, you know, longer and longer the farther before the third or fourth dynasty you go. And same thing in Chinese dynastic records. You know, the farther back you go, the longer these dynasties seem to last. Same thing in the Persian records. As a matter of fact, Sir Isaac Newton wrote a book about this called The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms, and he was trying to relate them to the precession cycle. But he didn't believe it, and so he figured that all these cultures must have just been lying, that, you know, that their people live so long. But even a scientific study, you know, if you zero in on just the last 300 years or so, you know, people live half the age spans that we live now just a couple hundred years ago. And we might say, oh, that's because, you know, we didn't have the medicine we have, or we didn't have the good foods that we eat nowadays. But, you know, what are these things? What is what is knowledge of healthcare or knowledge of agriculture? It's a manifestation of the expansion of consciousness. As our consciousness grows, we learn how to, you know, eat better and live better, and our ages will expand. And again, Sri Yukteswar, he's sort of the master at this because he gives a summary. He says that in the bottom age, the Kali Yuga, mankind lives roughly a maximum of 100 years. You rarely see somebody greater living older than that. In the Dwapara Yuga, or Bronze Age that we've just entered, you'll start to see a lot of people live to be several hundred years old by the middle or end of this age. And then in the Treta Yuga, 300 years is a good average. And in the Satya Yuga, or Golden Age, 400 years plus is not unusual. And we see people that seem to live these ancient, these long spans in the Bible, Seth, Methuselah, and others. And we think it's just a fairy tale, but boy, it is an awfully consistent fairy tale all around the world.
I think that's a great point to make, that kind of like what I often find is that a lot of people stare in isolation at these phenomena and say basically, oh, in the Bible there's like, you know, just 10 dudes who had this happen to them, but really when you start to realize that it's across the globe in so many cultures, a different picture begins to emerge, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, one with a lot more credibility. And and then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, what causes this? You know, if this cycle is real, and you look carefully at the anthropological record, the archaeological record, the linguistic record, it all points to some sort of a cycle there. And so that's where we've tried to focus with our, you know, our more technical stuff at the Binary Research Institute. What exactly causes this cycle, and how does that change consciousness?
Well, and I suppose that leads to my question, which is, what causes the end of a golden age? Is this something that is cataclysmic? Are we talking about, you know, the fact that there are flood mythologies all over the world that roughly can line up potentially with this idea of 13,000 years ago? Are we looking at something like that? Are we saying that Earth changes that might cause an age to shift are come about because of the stars? Help me kind of grasp this a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's sort of our classic looking at history through our current mindset syndrome, that, you know, we think of everything as having a physical cause now, so it must be, you know, some meteor hit the Earth or great flood, and certainly these things have happened, you know, just statistically. You're going to have super floods now and then, impacts from comets or asteroids or things. But I don't think that that's what the ancients were talking about. There's some nice verbiage on these cycles in Ecclesiastics. For everything, there's a time, a season, purpose unto heaven, and they talk a little bit about it, and that this turning of the seasons is inevitable. And it's not just the farming season we're talking about. When these ancient cultures are talking about this, especially ones that are higher in the cycle than we are, they're generally referring to the great year also. But also, if you look at the book of Job, there's a beautiful thing in there, which I think hints at what's going on here. And he says, "Canst thou bind the sweet influence of the Pleiades or loose the bands of Orion?" And so Job is asking a rhetorical question. He's a really wise man. And the answer to that question, "Canst thou bind the sweet influence of the Pleiades?" And we can talk about solar system stuff in a little bit later, you know, and it could be that, you know, this orbit our solar system is in, it pushes us a little more towards the Pleiades, and that's the sweet point, or point of sweet influence that that effectively causes a golden age, just as a summertime in the solar cycle is caused by, you know, the solar rays hitting the Earth more directly. But the answer to this rhetorical question, Kathleen, is no. You can't stay in the golden age any more than you can break apart the stars in Orion's band that you see up there in the sky. Those are fixed stars. So we can't stay in the golden age any more than we can stay in the summer, or we can stay in the glory of this, you know, beautiful morning I'm looking out my window at right here. Inevitably, the celestial bodies move, and inevitably, the cycle must change. It's just part of life.
And so essentially, these are really subtle energies that we're talking about. And so I think to your point, this mindset that we have that is so materially based wants to understand it from the point of view of saying, well, it must be a cataclysm, it must be a shift. But what you're saying is it's really just the natural course of our lives in our solar system.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And I like your terminology there, wants to. Yeah, when we're kind of at the lower age, that's, you know, we have to look at it through our present lens. You know, if we just went back 150 years and talked to a farmer around this area where I am right here, he wouldn't believe the stuff that we have, you know, that there's such things as animation, that we all carry devices and we can talk to different people on the other side of the world and send them pictures, and that we have robots on Mars and we can clone farm animals. I mean, it would just scare them. And likewise, we can hardly begin to understand the real workings of the universe, in my opinion. I think it's so much deeper than we believe right now.
So let's talk about the controversy. Because this has to be controversial in so many ways to traditional historians who are very easy to scare. So when we're looking at these ideas and we're looking at cultures, let's look at ancient Egypt for a minute. And the thing about Egypt that I think fascinates so many of us is this idea that Egypt did not evolve. Egypt arrives. All of a sudden, Egypt is. Now, does that fit into this idea that all of a sudden Egypt just sort of seems to appear with this extraordinary advanced culture? Is this related to this idea?
Fits it to a T. And not only Egypt, but when you look all around the world, roughly 5,000 years ago, call it 3,000 BC, where they're beginning to build, you know, massive structures there on the Giza Plateau. You know, we don't go from medium size or smaller structures. We go to the biggest pyramid on Earth pretty darn quickly. Mm-hmm. And same thing in England. You know, they're building with stones there that are 50 tons plus. You know, I was taught in the textbooks when I was a kid, because they weren't very good farmers, they needed to know when spring would arrive. And it's a ridiculous explanation, because, you know, if they weren't very good farmers, how do they have all the time to go mine 50 ton stones and carry them so far to build a Stonehenge or an Avebury or something like that? You know, if they don't know when spring is, how do they know to align them just perfectly to do this, to, you know, serve as a calendar and many other purposes, by the way. And so, yeah, it's not just Egypt. It's Mesopotamia. It's virtually every continent on Earth is beginning to build megalithic structures. Even though it's much easier to build with smaller things, they, for some reason, want to build with gigantic heavy stones. And I don't think we completely understand why this happens, but it's not a sign of a primitive culture. It's a sign of a pretty advanced culture. And, you know, my own personal belief is that, you know, they're very aware of this cycle, just as we're aware of the yearly cycle. And they're actually putting some things in place, some very heavy things in place, to try to hang on to some of the sweet influence of the higher ages, if you will, and incorporate some information. but that's a little bit deeper subject.
When you're trying to talk to people, bring it slightly back to the controversial aspect, you're just not telling people that there is this great tier cycle, which is more important. And I want to go into that a bit more soon. But also that our ancestors were aware of that. How does that get received when you organize conferences or speak to academics about this?
Well, you know, it's definitely in the minority point of view, but there is an awakening going on. You know, when I was a little boy, they taught us that civilization's roughly 5,000 years old. Before that, we were hunter-gatherers. The reasons cities weren't built earlier is that you needed writing to organize anything on a large scale, and that the first cities were built for self-defense from warring tribes. And that was the theory. And it was all pretty much just blown to pieces when they found things like, you know, Caral, Peru, which is, you know, contemporary with structures in the cradle of civilization and Egypt. We actually have pyramids here in the Americas that are just as old as the Egyptian pyramids. So, you know, how does that fit with an out of Africa slow evolution of mankind? It doesn't. Also, another thing at Caral, there's no evidence of weapons whatsoever. These people aren't getting together to ward off, you know, warring tribes. They're getting together for some reasons we don't understand. They're building these structures that appear to have some astronomical alignments to them. You find evidence there of textiles, fishing, seeds from thousands of miles away, shellfish, you know, 70 different types of shellfish. That's more than you find at the finest seafood restaurants in New York or someplace today. You know, very advanced cultures that are just out of sequence with the old ways that were teaching history. And so I think the first way the anthropologists, the status quo will approach this is, okay, maybe we're just a little wrong on the dates, you know, that things are a little older than we thought. They really have to say that now that they found Göbekli Tepe, Turkey, which is about 11,000 years old, you know, has carved structures. We never would have found these things had they not been purposely buried. That's in Turkey. Not only are things older, but, you know, if you had to have writing to build them and you don't find writing, then that changes that thing. And obviously, you don't need writing. And what it really fits with is more of a great year type of concept, you know, where there's a pre-Babel age. Again, if you look at the Bible, you know, in the pre-Babel era, supposedly mankind lived in tune with the earth, spoke with one tongue. It was very wonderful, peaceful world. And then around the time that mankind starts building structures, ziggurats over there, God so confuses the tongues that people start getting into fights and problems and things like that. And so on the way down, you know, you develop language because you can no longer understand each other clairvoyantly and telepathically. But if you look at the writings of many of the saints and sages, you know, who already have these higher age consciousness, such as Paramahansa Yogananda, who wrote Biography of a Yogi, he says that in the year 4100 AD, we will telepathy and clairvoyance will once again become common knowledge. And so, you know, the current structure of history doesn't have a context or a template to put a lot of these findings into. So it's forced into sort of a convoluted explanation. But as you study the great year more and more, I think people will realize how much sense it makes. And so I'm not too worried about the controversies and the facts that people don't buy into it. Now, you know, that's just where we are. We're still fairly low in our evolution of life.
You've been making a DVD, which is called The Great Year, and we've been speaking a lot about The Great Year. But your book is called The Lost Star of Myth and Symbolism. And really the question there is, what's the lost star?
Yeah, lost star of myth and time, right.
Sorry.
So yeah, you're getting right to the crux of the matter here, Philip. You know, so if the first cycle of day and night is caused by the Earth spinning on its axis relative to the sun, and the second cycle is caused by the Earth's revolution or orbit around the sun, and the third cycle is caused by the whole solar system moving, then yes, what is the solar system going around? And again, Yuktaswar is very explicit. He says, you know, this phenomenon that we call precession, this star is appearing to move across the sky at about 50 arc seconds per year, is caused by our sun's motion around a companion star. And some other cultures just barely hint at this, but you don't find a tremendous amount of detail. They just sort of make reference to the motion of the heavens. But when Yuktaswar wrote this thing that our sun has a companion star in 1894, based on, you know, Vedic teachings and some of his knowledge, there was almost no recognition in the astronomical community that most stars were actually companion stars. It was thought to be a very, very rare thing, binary or trinary star systems. And nowadays, if you look at the NASA Chandra website, you know, they'll say perhaps as many as 80% of all stars are in binary or multiple star relationships, meaning gravitationally bound to a similar mass. So at the very least, we have to say Yuktaswar was pretty prescient in his knowledge here. One thing that throws off this whole understanding right now is that there is a different theory for precession, a different theory for why we see the sun in a different constellation, you know, why the stars seem to move relative to the sun by 50 arc seconds per year. And that's the wobble theory that Copernicus came up with. We can't blame Copernicus too much because, you know, he was just coming out of the Dark Ages in 1543. He wrote De Revolutionibus. And before his time, people thought the Earth was the center of the solar system, you know, a typical Dark Age belief. It's all about us. And that the sun and everything else went around us. But they could see some quirky motions that weren't easily explained by this geocentric system. So Copernicus gave us the heliocentric system. And in doing so, he had to explain the three different astronomical observables. The first is we see the stars and the sun rise in the east and set in the west. And he said, okay, well, that's because the Earth spins. It's not because all those things are moving that much. And that satisfied that one. The second one, he said, oh, we can see a different constellation overhead roughly each month. He said, well, that's because the Earth goes around the sun, and so we're looking at a different portion of the sky roughly every 30 days or so. And so we'll see the 12 different constellations in a different month. And so that answered that astronomical observable. The third observable he had to explain is the precession of the equinox. Why do the stars appear to move across the sky retrograde at 50 arc seconds per year, or 1 degree every 72 years? And he had just established that the sun is the center of the solar system, the center of the universe, he called it. And so he couldn't then very well have the sun also moving. So he said the Earth must wobble. And that kind of stuck, and Newton came along and said, well, if the Earth wobbles, it has to be due to the gravity of the two closest masses, the sun and the moon, tugging on the oblate Earth. And so scientists have come up with formulas to explain how that might happen. But the current precession theory is just, it has a history of changes. It's called the lunisolar theory. And it's now has 1,400 inputs. It's the most complicated mathematical formula. And they have to change it every few years to try to get the formula to match the speed up in the motion of the stars that we're seeing. Just throw all that out and just say, we see the sun in a different constellation every 2,000 years or so because the sun actually moves. The solar system moves. And so it's a new paradigm that better explains the astronomical observers. And when you have that paradigm of a moving solar system, it also gives you a basis for another cycle, the cycle of the great year.
And so then the question becomes, are we any closer in identifying what we are involved with? What kind of a binary star system are we a part of?
Well, there's sort of two schools of thought there. And I was, one of only a couple of guys that were sort of singing this tune 10 years ago. And now there seems to be actually a fair amount of credible scientists that are saying there must be something out there. And probably one of the most credible scientists is Mike Brown. He's at Caltech University here in California. They're famous for helping JPL launch all these rockets and things. And he has found more KBOs, Kuiper Belt objects, than anybody, including Sedna, this one with this really weird orbit. If you look at Mike Brown's website, he says Sedna can't be there unless there is something else that's pretty massive farther out. And so he's looking for either a big 10th planet or a companion star. Same thing with Richard Muller at University of Berkeley. He's trying to find it to explain, periodic extinctions you have now and then. Whitmire and Matisse at the University of Louisiana, they're looking for something. And most of these guys are all going down the sort of the traditional astronomical path that we understand everything about the universe, therefore it must be a star we can't see, a brown dwarf or a red dwarf towards the center of the galaxy where such an object might be very difficult to pick up. Or I met with some guys up at Stanford because they were getting some really funny data out of Gravity Probe B, and they actually think there might be a black hole or something like that. So all these, one school of thought here, the traditional astronomy is looking for a very difficult to see object. And then there's another school of thought, which I guess you put me in, which is there's a possibility it could be a visible star. And it's not so out there. If our solar system is moving faster than we expect it is, then it's a possibility that we could be in a relationship with a nearby visible star. And Bernard's star is moving very quickly. I have a group of people that email me about that, and that's been an area of study. Sirius is another star that's obviously it's the brightest star in the sky, so it'd be a good example there. And there is a lot of myth and folklore about Sirius. The Shinto religion out of Japan actually calls it our second sun, and they align their temples to it. Sirius sits below the ecliptic in the southwest. The ancient Egyptians, they talked about Sirius. They revered Sirius as Isis. They said that she would bring life and then take it away. And modern archaeologists interpret this that, that just means that when the Nile floods, they tied that to the rising of Sirius. But I think it has a deeper meaning. I think they're referring to this longer cycle. And they even, in their iconography, they show Sirius very close to Horus, which is an aspect of the sun. And so Sirius Isis is often cradling baby Horus, the sun, like a mother and child, you know, a Madonna sort of picture. Or when Horus is older, you see these pictures of Isis actually moving Horus. And so I think there's some mythology there that hints at a relationship with Sirius. But quite frankly, Philip, we have a lot of work to do to figure these things out, and that's our main focus right now.
And before I'm going to ask you what the next steps are in your research and your life, just picking up on the Sirius thing, a very good friend of mine, Wim Zitman, and the reason why we've never interviewed him is because, unfortunately, his English isn't good enough to get him on the radio. But he's done an awful lot of research into ancient Egypt, and his book, Egypt Image of Heaven, is one which I tried to get published and was published in the English language. And he's absolutely convinced, when he was looking at Egyptian mythology, that, as you say, that there is this mother aspect to Sirius in relationship to our solar system, and that there is even records of ancient Egyptians saying that somehow there's like an umbilical cord between Ars and Sirius, and this is how they express that bond between the two stars. So, Walter, you've got your organization, you're trying to get more people interested and trying to do more research. What are your immediate next steps, and what is your hope for the long-term future to do with your research?
Well, we're working on several fronts, Philip. One, we're just coming out with a children's book on the great year to introduce the concept to people at a little bit earlier age. And it's done in a really simple way, too. So I'm excited about that. It'll be out this fall. It's called The Great Year Adventures. With it's got a couple of neat little characters in there. We put on our regular conferences where we bring together different experts that talk about the cycle of the ages from different perspectives. So Robert Schock, a geologist with Boston University, will be there. He's famed for redating the Sphinx. Maybe you've had him on your show. And Laird Scranton talking about myth and symbol. A brilliant new author, Joseph Selby, he actually teaches a class on the yugas at Ananda University in Northern California. And he's coming out with really the Bible on the yugas. In my opinion, it's a thick book. It really details what all the ages are like. How consciousness transitions, and it's he'll be there. And you know, off the top of my head, I can't remember everybody, but anybody that's interested in that can go to cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com. And our next conference is in Sedona. We also do some podcasts, but and, you know, we put out the book and DVD, which you mentioned. But my love, kind of what I spend most of my idle time on, is just sort of the hard science, the research. And so we're doing a new paper right now on the cause and consequences of solar system motion. And it pulls together a lot of solar system anomalies and explains them, basically solves them all when you use a moving solar system model rather than a static solar system model, which most astronomers use right now.
Sometimes it's just small things which make a completely different understanding and make you realize that our ancestors knew far more than we do. So if people want to learn more about all of that research, you've got a number of websites, haven't you? Apart from cpaconline.com for the conference, where else can they get to?
Yeah, the main research one for the nerds out there is binaryresearchinstitute.org. And there's a lot of papers, a lot of animation there. You can just see how we think the whole system moves. But, you know, for just the average person, I would say start with the book Lost Star of Myth and Time. Besides, you know, talking about the ancient myth and folklore and the binary system, it has sort of the bridge between the two, which is a hypothesis for how solar system motion and a change in the stellar electromagnetic environment might actually impact consciousness.
I want to jump in there and say that when I went on to Amazon to buy this book, The Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden, it actually brought up a really wonderful package of three products that it's selling together, and that is Walter's DVD, The Great Year, which I'm very excited to watch, narrated by James Earl Jones, Walter's book, The Lost Star of Myth and Time, but also the book, The Holy Science, which you have been talking about a lot here. So I was excited to see that they've packaged all three of those things together, and I just bought all three of them, and we'll also have links up on our website so that people can take a look at your book, your DVD, and the work that you're doing. So it'll be easy if people want to go to our website, thespiritrevolution.com. We will put everything up there for them as well.
Excellent, excellent. And one last quick point there. In The Holy Science, Yukteswar makes the most beautiful point of all, and he says, you don't have to wait for a golden age to have a higher consciousness. There are things we can do now, just as there are things we can do to see at night, you know, like flashlights, or to stay warm in the winter, or not starve in the winter. Likewise, there are things we can do in the lower ages of the great year cycle to bring about enlightenment now, and that's the main message there. It's a beautiful, beautiful book.
Absolutely, and you have definitely brought us enlightenment today, Walter. I'm very glad that we don't have to wait until 4100 AD for some things to come back which we have lost along the way. But for now, we have reached the end of our show. For people who want to listen to this again, all our shows are being archived, and there are three main locations where you go get and see them, or listen to them, rather. One of them is, of course, the BBS Radio Archives. The second one is our own website, thespiritrevolution.com, where you will always find the last five episodes for free immediately for download and or listen from the website. If you want to hear more than a year's worth of our shows, you need to go to iTunes, and the link to iTunes is available from our website as well, or just go into iTunes and search for The Spirit Revolution and you will find us there. So, Walter, thank you so much for being our guest this week. I wish you all the very best, and we will put all your information as usual on the website. But until next week, from the two of us,
the truth against the world.